Well, let me welcome everyone here tonight. My name's Tony Giddens, Director of the LSE, and I'm very pleased to welcome Jeff Berg to the school for his lecture tonight. Jeff Berg is a Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of International Creative Management, Inc., which is a talent and literary agency representing clients in fields of publishing, motion pictures, television, music, theatre, news, and public affairs. ICM is one of the leading agencies in the United States and Europe, with its principal offices in Los Angeles, New York, London, and Dublin. Jeff Berg graduated with honors in English from the University of California at Berkeley and received a Master of Liberal Arts from the University of Southern California. He joined Creative Management Associates, one of ICM's predecessor agencies, in 1969 as a literary and film agent, and became president of the company in 1980. In 1985, he became the chairman. He is regarded by everyone as one of the foremost agents in the entertainment industry. His experience in representing artists and production companies applies to both the American and international marketplaces. I believe he's quite often in London, for example, and he has worked extensively with global media, entertainment, and telecommunication companies. Among the individuals he represents are Arnold Schwarzenegger, Julia Roberts, Denzel Washington, Michelle Pfeiffer, and I think quite a galaxy of others as well. He currently serves as co-chair of the California Information Technology Council. He is a member of the Board of Visitors of the Anderson Graduate School of Management at UCLA and the Board of Trustees of Pomona College. He is also on the Board of Directors at Oracle Corporation and Excite, Inc. He was awarded a Companion of the Order of Merit of the Republic of Italy in 1991. He is also an experienced lecturer, having lectured on management and finance, and still does so, I think, in the arts at Columbia University and UCLA. Let me again say how pleased I am to welcome him here tonight. His title is Media Companies and the Creation of Value. Jeff Berg.
Thank you, Anthony. When I was at Berkeley in the 60s, we like to believe that as an academic and intellectual environment that we really influenced the United States, which I think was true, but what was also true was that if anything, LSE had influenced Berkeley. It was one of the rare opportunities when we were always looking on the other side to see what was going on here in the social sciences. I wanted to talk this evening about media in general, and this is a very vexing and daunting theme because you're going to find out, if you accept my argument, that media companies as we know them today are really becoming entirely different other kinds of animals as we might know them. And there are deep present effects to how we think about media, how we regard media, how we look at media. And I think the reason why is that basically, as a nation here and as a nation in the United States, we wind up consuming it all day long. It starts in the morning, it goes throughout your entire workday, and it affects the nature of how you do work. It restructures work as it has been traditionally been done, and it also affects your relationships and your associations with family, with friends, with intimates, with colleagues. So one of the things that I want to focus on is how we think about media companies today, what's the present nature of media companies as opposed to what existed 5, even 10 years ago. So from that point of view, I'm going to give you a little historical perspective and talk a bit how traditional media companies operated, and try to give you a look at it through the lens of the talent agency business. And the agency business is a unique structure in itself because you'll find when you look at media companies, generally, their platforms, their delivery systems, they're in the newspaper business, their studios, their networks, their satellite providers. But finally, you need to put something on these systems for it to have any inherent value, either to the shareholders on one hand in terms of generating rents or to the consumers in terms of what is it that you're actually watching. So from that point of view, you might want to think about a simpler time when you had a network, when you had a studio, and the principal job of that studio was basically to deliver a motion picture. And what the studios would do in the 60s, whether it was 20th Century Fox or Columbia Studios or Universal or Warner's, they produced movies, they financed movies, and they distributed movies. They were really not in any other business at that time other than the production of television, which is also a very robust business. I'm going to talk about that in a moment. But if you look at those same companies today, whether it's 20th Century Fox or Warner Brothers, you find that the movie business itself, which was the high value proposition of these companies 20 years ago, are now kind of a dot on the landscape in terms of the other revenues and the other business combinations that have been put together. The best example is to look what's happened to 20th Century Fox, which is now News Corp, and begin to see that even with the success of Titanic, which was an enormous box office hit for Fox, if you look at it in relationship to the other moving parts, whether it's their news division, their sports teams, whether it's the Los Angeles Dodgers on one hand or Manchester United on the other, their real estate holdings, their television network, their sports franchises, and all of the other associated media properties, that the movie business almost becomes a secondary piece of the whole. And you could also make the same case for Warner Brothers, which clearly was one of the major studios over a 50-year period. Now, the movie division, again, is a secondary, maybe even a tertiary part of what goes on in the Time Warner empire when you have companies like CNN, Time Life, the publishing empire, their television syndication business, the Atlantic Braves, various sports franchises. So what you begin to find happening right now is these media companies are involved in three aspects of the market. Content, which is another word for programming or editorial, if you will. And in order for content to drive the market and make sense, it has to be executed and delivered by highly qualified, highly skilled talent. That's our role. And that's a question of, does talent get adequately compensated for the job they do? Now, you see these captains of industry on the media side saying, well, the talent is making too much money. Now, the truth of the matter is, the people who are really making the money in the media companies today are the owners and the managers of the media companies. And what we're trying to do is just get talent to catch up to the owners themselves. So you've got the content side, then you have carriage and distribution. Well, what does that mean? I mean, that can apply to whether these studios have created networks, and in the case of Warner Brothers and Fox, they both have networks right now. They have satellite access, they have digital channels, they have cable channels, they have retail stores. Again, we talked about their sports franchises. They have news capability. So distribution has to be part of the strategy of any of these significant media companies. And finally, you have what I would just call enabling technologies or tools, which largely applies to what the next iteration of media is going to be, which is going to be internet distribution, or if you will, new media. New media is in itself not so new, but it's going to begin to get globalized on a basis where I don't think we've even begun to realize the ramifications of its commercial impact. Anthony, a moment ago, mentioned that I'm on the board of directors of a company in California called Excite. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Excite. It's one of the major internet portals in the United States, and we've just concluded a deal in the UK to replicate that business with BT, who's going to be the technology partner for Excite. You also have all of the major media companies making significant investments, not only in terms of upgrading their networks and providing new channels of distribution, but they've also now become software companies, as well as whatever investments they might have in hardware. And another kind of media company to think of as a way of expanding the frame, because I don't want media just to be regarded as the movie business or the television business, but you would also have to include all forms of telecommunication, all forms of satellite delivery, all forms of cable delivery, and the economies of scale here are going to get very formidable. And in a moment, I'm going to walk you through some of the dollars and give you a sense of actually how radical those economies are. The focus right now in the United States is really going to be on how these companies compete, not just for audience or for market share, but what I think the internet component of media is going to be all about is how commerce is going to get generated in an electronic environment. And that's going to represent a very significant piece of the market. In fact, it might be so significant that to leave that end out in terms of what's going to be asked of you as consumers might be as profound of a seismic shift 15 years ago when IBM didn't realize what business it was really in. IBM thought it was in the business of making computers and machines without realizing that the business they were really in was managing complex information. So the media companies are going to be not only involved in sending you material and news, but there will be a significant electronic commerce component to that as well. The agency business is that point on the horizon where talent, ideas, finance, production capital, marketing, and distribution all line up. And what we basically do is one of a handful of things. We advise and guide the careers of our clients. We structure complex transactions on their behalf. We seek opportunity for them. But what we also do, in order to allow the opportunity to even exist in the first place, is we try to raise the money and find the patterns of distribution so that client's individual project can get set up. If we succeed in that endeavor, we live another day. The client has a successful career, a successful movie, or a television show, and we then are involved in the next project. One of the things that also seems unique about media companies today, again in comparison to 25 or 30 years ago, is that talent as a community is not generally under long-term contract to their media brethren. It's pretty much a freelance economy today, which we think is good news because it gives the artist the right to really benefit from his talent in the market at any given moment. My friend Emma Duncan, who writes for The Economist, has written extensively about this, where the flows of power reside right now in the media business. Some people would have you think it's that the power exists within the distribution community, those people who have access to your homes, to carriage. Other people think it's the content. A third community thinks it's really about the talent. I think it's probably unfair to polarize any of them because in order to build a successful media organization, you need all three of those elements working in unison at any one moment. My argument really is that media companies are both buyers and sellers in an ever complex series of relationships that force them, the media companies, to both cooperate and compete with each other. Now, that's a long way of saying that media companies in the United States as well as Europe, which you can follow with a greater degree of complexity because I think this is a much tougher regulatory environment to navigate, is they're supplying each other with products. They're also competing with each other. They're joint ventured on a number of structures, such as a company like UIP, which is one of the major distribution companies in the world. And they also tear each other's hearts out when movies are competing for an opening date. So this is not a binary world. It's not zeros and ones. There's a lot of gray. There's a lot of overlap. And there's a lot of confusion about how these companies really operate internally. Secondly, how they create value is really through highly differentiated product, which again gets down to the issue of talent. Whether that's the quality of a performance, the skill in a director's execution, the excellence or the narrative complexity of a screenplay on one hand, or the technical virtuosity of what you see either in a play or in a movie or in a television show. For us right now, this product, call it programming, call it editorial, needs to be channeled through unique delivery systems in what's becoming a highly branded environment. And I use the word branded with some degree of caution, because what you're also finding right now is that these media companies are no longer just pure delivery systems of content, but they're highly sophisticated, complex marketing organizations that over the course of a weekend can determine the fate of a $100 million movie. So the stakes are increasingly high. The media companies on a pro rata level are spending practically as much as the major consumer product manufacturers like Colgate, Palmolive, General Motors, Procter & Gamble. These are big bets that are taking place. And the marketing strategies more than ever become vital because of the intense competition and capacity in the market. Therefore, brands like Microsoft, MTV, CNN, Discovery, Virgin, really are going to become the iconographic signposts for the 21st century. And these are all highly driven marketing organizations as well as programming companies. Media as a phrase of art, if you've paid attention to Marshall McLuhan, actually embraces a cluster of businesses, and they revolve around several sectors of the market itself. So it's no longer just about publishing any more than it's just about movies and television. But you wind up spilling into related themes, related areas, like advertising, like telecommunications, satellite delivery, the cable business, the software business, the computer business, and of course the entertainment business itself. If you begin to add up the total economies generated by these areas, you quickly exceed, in my mind, just doing some rough math before the fact, you quickly exceed in excess of $1.5 trillion. And I get there in the following direction. The movie business itself is the smallest piece of it. At the box office, the movie business generates about $12 billion a year. It's single-digit growth. It's a good business, but the high value is not contained there. The real business that's being generated right now, and where I think media companies have a tremendous opportunity to leverage off on their franchises, is what's going to be going on in new satellite delivery, what's going on internationally in the cable business, the network broadcast business, the first-run syndication business. And these areas are generating, you know, together with print, which is everything from newspapers to publishing, this is a business that approaches worldwide $500 billion. I would also include music in there. Recorded music as well as music publishing is about a $55 billion a year business. These are not small numbers. And the media companies themselves realize that whereas 4 or 5 years ago, everyone felt that these new forms of delivery would begin to cannibalize over old markets. In fact, the opposite is beginning to take place. What they're beginning to realize is you can create new markets and protect old markets just the same. So the question is, what are the hurdles? If all of this is such a rosy picture, if all of this sounds right, and the stock market is really supporting the prices of media companies and cable companies and telecoms, what are the real hurdles or what are the obstacles to growth that I see over the next several years? And there are several. One, if you were to do a competitive analysis of how these studios and networks and media companies are set up, and I'm principally referring to the ones in America, although you can make analogous arguments about the ones in the UK and in Europe itself, they're all missing one critical piece. Fox, and I think Rupert Murdoch has probably developed, along with Time Warner, the most sophisticated distribution strategies because he's really playing the satellite card heavily. But he's gone into also an equally heavy sports investment, but he's missing music. Seagram's has just divested partially from their television business and has invested heavily in music, as you know from the PolyGram acquisition. Warner Brothers is heavily invested in cable, as is in Viacom, but yet they're missing certain other franchises that some of their brethren have. So at any moment, there's not a complete lineup of what's going on, and the missing piece for a lot of these companies is going to be a highly evolved internet strategy, which is why you saw the Disney company take a big position in InfoSeek, which is one of Excite's and Yahoo's competitive portals in the United States. All of the companies right now are looking to the internet for two principal reasons. One, a channel of marketing, promotion, distribution, and advertising for their products, whether they're CDs or books or home videos. But they're also looking at the internet and their custom-built sites to generate licensing income, merchandising income, and any other associated product that they could find that goes along with an entertainment product, whether it's a CD or a video or a marketing tie-in. We think right now the competitive analysis then leads to the next issue, which is what the regulatory environment is. And from that point of view, there have been historical debates in Europe about, you know, at both the DG7 and the DG10 level about whether or not there is going to be a free exchange of ideas, of audiovisual products. This will continue to get played out as Europe goes into the monetary system that you, at some point, may or may not join. But that's going to have some very real ramifications in terms of how rents are extracted out of foreign markets and remitted to the home market. In America, there are also very significant regulatory hurdles in everything from spectrum agreements that the networks are going to begin to expire in several years. There's a debate going on right now about digital must carry. Are the cable operators going to be required to build out and carry 500 channels in their new digital set-top boxes? And also, the most fundamental one is just by virtue of how government operates in Western Europe through the formation of your various ministries of culture. Culture basically in the UK is a political phenomenon. In the United States, it's purely a commercial phenomenon. We don't have a minister of film or a minister of culture or a minister of sport. The other difficult area is what I would regard as metrics. How is media measured? And how is success quantified when, in fact, when you look at the life of an audiovisual product, it could be 10, 20, 30 years. The best example of that is that if you look at Star Wars, which was just re-released last year after a 20-year hiatus, it went out in the market, made a couple of $100 million all over again. A normal analyst or investment banker wouldn't be carrying that asset at that level of appreciation unless he knew that the world was about to go into a completely new form of delivery, which I'm again going to touch on in a moment. And the last area has to do with what the national interest is in relationship to a highly defined audiovisual policy. In that sense, there's a philosopher at the University of Virginia, Richard Rorty, who remarked that national interest for a country is a little like self-respect for an individual. A little of it is a good thing. A lot of it can lead to arrogance, and a great deal of it can lock you right out of a market. I think national interest almost becomes a tautology when you begin to think about audiovisual policy, because I'm not sure audiovisual policy in a globalized market is even a relevant characteristic to think about. I think what is important to think about is training, job formation, competing in a market that delivers a lot of high-value jobs and high-value characteristics in terms of secondary rights. But how it fits into national interest, I'm not quite sure. And what we also know about all of these media companies is that by definition, media companies tend to miss the next wave or the next iteration of technological development, which is why you saw the radio industry miss television, television missed cable, cable missed video, and video missed the internet. So what it does is it constantly spills over into the next generation where new economic opportunity can exist. So I want to talk a little about some of these changes in delivery and how it's going to, I believe, affect the landscape and the way you consume media and the way you actually get access to it. I think a big change at the theater level, which I believe the technical capability is there now, but the industry hasn't adapted the standard, is satellite delivery directly to your local cinema. Well, what that does right out of the box is it puts something called prints out of business. There will be no celluloid prints at some point in the exhibition business. Each theater will have a dish, will have an earth station. The movie studio or the server will beam a high-resolution image to that dish from a satellite, and it'll go through something called a light valve, which will have the quality, cinematically, of what you're used to seeing in your neighborhood theater. That's a tremendous economy of scale and saving that can be made at both the distribution level and at a physical print cost level. Next, home video, as we know it, works right now on a video cassette. Magnetic tape flutters around. You play it 5 times. The machine eats it up. It loses, it degrades as it goes across the magnetic head. That's all going to go to digital video disc. Brilliant system, brilliant technology, much higher resolution, laser, no real moving parts. We think that is probably going to be a $50 billion piece of new business because all of you will scrap your VCR, you don't know how to work them anyway, and it's going to create, I think, a whole new consumer electronic business for the manufacturers on one hand, but also for the rights holders, it's going to generate all new libraries all over again, and that's going to be a big win. For the home consumer, I think we're going to get out of 525 NTSC progressive scanning, and we're going to move into high-definition television. If you've seen it, it's as profound as looking at black and white versus color. You will ask yourself, why didn't you have this 10 years ago? That's going to be a question of price points and how it's introduced to the market. But again, that's going to be a brilliant new delivery system, which I think is going to totally change the character of what you see. Another big issue, right now there's limited spectrum on the cable systems. With new digital set-top boxes, there's going to be infinite capacity, which means as a consumer, you're going to have the ability to engage in any kind of niche programming that you want, which means you're going to have custom-made channels built out for you. Record distribution, well, already a lot of you probably buy CDs on Amazon.com or CD Now. That's probably going to move soon to internet delivery on readable CDs. The record industry is moving towards a standard, I believe, that's going to embrace this. You'll pay a license fee to download it, and could be an enormous business. As I say, the recorded music business right now in Europe and Asia and the United States is a $36 billion business. Someone is going to say there's going to be an easier way for you to retrieve this information. Another big area, I think, is the whole area of enhanced broadcasting. I talked a little earlier about some of the new enabling technologies. And an example of that is this company in Northern California called Wink Communications. Wink Communications is a software company that's going to allow you as a television consumer to have a graphical overlay on your TV screen, which will allow you to address it directly to receive information, specialized services, merchandise, and all of the major cable operators and networks and a lot of the major advertisers are supporting this as the standard of enhanced broadcasting over the next generation. And we think this new company has a big shot. The other thing is, we were talking about some of the internet portals. We believe they're going to slowly over time replace the Yellow Pages, both in Europe and the United States. There are obviously some other new technologies coming along. Fiber optics are going to replace twisted pairs in the phone world. There are going to be new tiers of services, new kind of premium delivery systems. And all of that, again, I think is going to be driven by the quality or the differentiation of the kind of artistic talent that goes into the programming, which is going to really make sense of this to begin with. When I was talking a moment ago about rights, I think it's also important to understand that media companies, aside from manufacturing this material and delivering it, are also in the business of managing a complex series of relationships, which loosely I'll call rights. They're legal rights, they're commercial rights, they're distribution rights, and they're also creative rights. And sometimes these rights are in conflict. Because finally, what the media companies are doing is they are being granted the rights or the license to exploit these audiovisual products, whether it's the copyright for a book and an author receives a royalty, or an artist in a film, whether a star or director is going to get a gross participation of the film revenues. Rights are really what drive the market. And a way to look at rights is to think of them as an abstraction that exists in three dimensions. One, rights exist over time. Rights exist in defined windows of availability, like theatrical, television, home video, syndication. And they also exist by region. If you buy into Samuel Huntington's premise that he talks about in The Clash of Civilizations, we're more or less victims of the fallacy of the West. We're basically selling audiovisual products or delivering audiovisual products to about one-fifth of the globe. We're reaching an audience of several hundred million people, not 5 billion. If you acknowledge as a given that these new markets are going to open up in Asia, in the Soviet Union, and will begin to move to a dollar standard, where people can actually get paid for the utilization of this intellectual property, we think that the market actually over the next 5 years could go through a doubling process all over again. So the regional right to exploit is as valuable as the period of time or the license, the temporal license, that a media company has to engage in the sales process in one of these projects. The other area which doesn't have day-to-day applicability now to the media business because a lot of other private networks like Oracle, like Microsoft, like IBM, and Novell and Sun Microsystems and America Online, they're looking to develop is the whole world of what the networked economy is going to be, which is really life on the internet. And in that sense, at Oracle, which is a company I'm fortunate enough to be on the board of, we're looking at that network economy business as something that could literally be $500 billion by the year 2004, 2005. And that's going to exist both business to business, where corporations will have their own private networks, which will be high-speed data links as well as inter and intranet capability, as well as running all of their enterprise on the net itself and moving away from traditional servers and traditional operating systems. One of Larry Ellison's key arguments is that you have more functionality than you need right now, and to the degree that can be professionally managed by network administrators, you're better off moving in that direction anyway. Anyway, if he's right, it's going to be a big win for Oracle. I think the other thing that you see is that what's going to really drive the market over the next couple of years is not just a question of who has the best movie, who has the most successful television show, or what advertisement is going to win the most Clio awards for the most clever form of advertisement. It's really going to get down to how you can merge successful financial marketing and programming strategies in the same direction. And in that sense, the migration of value is changing radically in America, as well as it's changing in the United States. There is full bore competition for households and consumers right now, and I think one of the most ostensible forms of value migration is what we've seen in the network television business in the United States, where 10 years ago, the networks controlled 90% of the market, and they more or less dominated that world. Right now, of the top 10 channels in the United States, they're all cable channels that have the highest margins of profitability. The top 10 markets have 30% margins of profitability. The bottom 10 channels are the traditional broadcasters who have operating profits and margins between 10 and 20%. So you can see that what Wall Street is looking at is not so much current performance, but future expectation and discounting backwards, which is why the cable stocks are back in a very significant way right now. The holy trinity for these companies is going to get down to how they deliver to you news, entertainment, and communication. And I would say as a subset of communication, that's really going to be the whole area of e-commerce. And e-commerce, as I said, is going to be part of that $500 billion business that's just on the other side of the horizon right now. The competition for these networks is not just coming from conventional sources. I think it's also interesting, if you look at France, that two key franchise holders, the French Railroad on one hand and Compagnie Générale des Eaux, which is now Vivendi, are the principal owners and purveyors of the water company and the railroad, but they have significant interests in cable television, in Canal Plus, in cellular phone delivery. And what you're beginning to find is that the public utilities, the commodity providers, are moving not only tonnage, but they're moving bits of compressed digital data. And they're doing it based on their unique powers of rights of way in their home markets. And I also think, you know, you're going to begin to see, you would have to ask yourself in the United States or the UK, why didn't the power company or the light company or the water company be the person to deliver you cable into your home? They already have two pipes into your home to begin with, as well as the phone company. So the next iteration is really going to be these companies fighting for one complete utility that they deliver you, what I call the Holy Trinity. They want to deliver you full service communication, full service entertainment, and full service news and information. And to the degree they can begin to deliver you a bill for £120 a month, as opposed to £20 for cable and £20 for something else or phone, you're going to begin to see a kind of wholesale consolidation of services. And again, this is going to get really down to how they begin to market this in a complex way. So as I said, the stakes are real. I mean, if telecommunications right now is a $1 trillion a year business on its way to a $2 trillion business in the lesser developed markets that are beginning to go online, or where they're leapfrogging traditional infrastructure and going right into a wireless world, you can bet that that the cellular providers are going to be wanting to sell you things beyond a phone call itself. They're going to move into all of these specialized services. And the one area that I didn't mention earlier when I was talking about what it is that the studios are providing, the other big area is that they're developing significant retail capability on the ground in major cities. So you can just look at the Disney shops, the Warner shops, and the consumer experience is really going to be the next part of how they create value, both on a on-site environment and in an online sense as well. So this value proposition is going to be driven by the talent, because you're going to have to access something that you really can't get elsewhere, and it's going to be a function of how it's marketed to you in a unique way, and to the degree these media companies can fully connect you. They truly want to own you as consumers. I think that's a good thing in itself. The question is whether or not they stifle innovation along the way. And I think one of the key things we're seeing right now in America is, as networks also own studios and programming, where they're buying from themselves, it doesn't necessarily mean that their shows or their products are going to be any better than if they outsourced it to independent third parties. And what it also means is it's going to be much tougher for independent producers and talent to access capital and these sources of distribution. So if you take into account that it's taken 20-25 years for these new networks to get created, the media companies themselves are, if you look at them, neural networks. And they're being structured to mimic human thought and anticipate human activity. And in fact, the more you acquire and buy in a data-based environment, whether it's Blockbuster, incidentally, Blockbuster knows more about you than you can imagine. They know your buying habits, they know your thematic habits, they know your interests. And to the degree that data, as Amazon.com, can be manipulated and refined, they're going to begin to anticipate your needs at every step of the way. And the smart media companies are looking at this database activity as a form of providing that added value proposition. So what you've really got right now is an increasingly secular business, highly diversified, complex financial structures. It's not cyclical. It's subject to share price variation, but it is going to be the driving aspect of the economy in the 21st century. I hope I've given you some ideas to think about, and it's a privilege joining you this evening. Thanks very much.
Well, I would say there are plenty of ideas to think about there. We've got, quarter of an hour or so for questions. Anyone? I'm trying to get the air conditioning turned on, by the way.
Well, it's better than the jackhammer that was going on in the street
before. I believe it has now
been
turned on. So the floor is open to questions, anyway. There's a microphone going around the...
Too much. You were partly talking about creation of value, referring to talent, the management of talent.
Yes.
Can you hear me? Yeah. I was wondering, if I understand your value chain analysis correctly, then the origin of value is talent, the management and marketing of talent. You also talked about the, or in fact analyzed the, excuse me, network economy, the media network, in fact. I was wondering, how do you balance off the management and marketing of talent versus that enormous of the network economy?
I think right now for us, it's not an either-or proposition. I think for us really to guide our clients correctly at this moment in the market, we have to become expert evaluators of marketing and media as well as distribution, as opposed to just securing a transaction on behalf of our client. That's kind of like looking at the tip of the iceberg. Generally, we live through the entire project with our clients all the way throughout the marketing and the distribution process globally. And as the value of the revenues increases internationally, it's really incumbent upon us to be a part of that process, which is one of the reasons why we're lucky enough to, I think, have one of the best agencies outside of the United States here at ICM. We really focus on the distribution and marketing end as thoroughly as we do on the production piece.
Gentleman down the front here.
Thank you. I was interested in your early comment about the way in which in the United States culture was purely commercial, not political, and you contrasted this to Europe.
Let me make a quick proviso there. It's commercial from a mass medium point of view. I'm not suggesting there's not a role for high culture in any society. There is. I was really directing myself to instruments of mass communication, which historically have been engines of low-price economies. Traditionally, television and newspapers are financed by advertisers. And I think there is quite a different political structure that exists here in relation to culture.
No, I would agree with you. I mean, I would also agree with your qualification. But I was also struck by the introduction, which mentioned that you talked about arts management at Columbia, and I think it was at UCLA. Is there any interchange that you can see between what one can broadly call the commercial side of culture and the political, or what one can perhaps regard as the sort of the high culture, the subsidized part of the sector, which you see in Europe? And is there a possibility for an exchange of management and managerial skills? Are any of the skills which are relevant to the commercial sector relevant to the subsidized sector? I raise this in the light of...
I think that's a great question. And in fact, if you read the leader in today's Economist, there is a piece directed exactly towards that, which is, does the UK rationally exploit and take advantage of its unique intellectual character in the area of export, globalization, marketing, and production? And the conclusion in the leader is that it doesn't, but yet the quality of the work is of an outstanding level. So the missing element in that equation, one would conclude, is management. And I think there's a lot to learn from the private sector, and conversely, there's a lot the private sector can learn in terms of public arts administration.
You mentioned early on the different sectors in the media might not necessarily be accountable of each other. They can help each other to create new market. But as human beings, we have only like a maximum 24 hours to receive information. Right? Can you tell me like how can different sectors help each other to create new markets?
Well, you know, Einstein warped time, and I think we may wind up having longer than a 24-hour day. As it relates to the consumption or assimilation of media and information. That's one answer. I think you're going to begin to do that through what in the internet is regarded as push technology, where specialized and customized information is going to come to you on your PC, which will have a built-in editorial discriminating function which, in essence, will save you time by focusing on those things you need to know in your life, whether your professional life, your academic life, your personal life. And I think that's one of the areas of filtering or editorial choice that has value.
So what you mean is the technology or the media in the future might determine what we are going to see, right? They help us, sort of like help us, or they determine what we are going to see in the future.
Well, there's too much choice already. I mean, you can't begin to really make sense out of the offerings of what's published or what comes out on a magazine or what's on television. So I think the next big issue for the consumer is finding ways to help them discriminate where they want to spend their leisure time.
We take someone up the top. I don't know, is there a microphone up the top? Someone in the front. Yeah, there is a microphone there.
Yeah, I could just ask.
You could shout anyway, you couldn't, okay. I'm sure you could hear. Right?
One of the areas where the UK is, I suppose, leading the field is in the area of digital television. And you talked about that company in the US. I mean, that already exists in the UK. You have Sky that already has a digital
You know, the beauty of being in the agency business is that we don't have to place technology bets, and we deal with all of the companies. I'm a big believer, however, in direct broadcasting by satellite. I think if you look at the new consumers and the new subscribers, it's growing at a faster rate of change right now than the cable subscribers. They're, you know, DirecTV in America has gone from zero to over 4 million in about 3.5 years. That's very strong penetration, considering that the premise of DirecTV was to reach those exurban or rural audiences, when in fact it's now being marketed and purchased by suburban, urban users who like the sports package or like the musical or like the movie packages. I think satellite offers tremendous operating characteristics if you can solve the back channel, if you can solve the two-way end of it. But you're right, the UK has made significant advances in the digital platform that we're not up to speed with yet. But I think you'll begin to see it in America this year and next.
Okay, another person in the middle up top there. Do you mind going on?
No, I leave it with you.
Thank you. Do you believe that value is being created by the ongoing breakup?
Hold the mic a bit
further away. Do you believe that any value is being created by the ongoing breakup of two of the currently most traditional distribution outlets, that is PolyGram at the moment, and the probable breakup of UIP?
That's a good question. I think the film production strategy at PolyGram, while it created, I think, some excellent films, did not reach the level of profitability that the owners and the shareholders wanted, so I feel that that sale was inevitable. Combined with the fact that Mr. Bronfman really wanted to build the global music powerhouse, it turned into, I think, for Seagram's, the right deal, because it puts MCA, Universal, in the market-leading position in recorded music right now. I don't like to see any audiovisual or production company go out of business, because that's one less buyer, but at the same time, you know, we'll find a new one. But they're hard to replace at that level of scale.
And UIP?
I don't believe UIP is going to break up. I think it performed, while it has significant market share here, I think what it's likely to do is engage in local production in the G7 markets as a way of ameliorating its political problems. But UIP is an extremely well-run, efficient distribution organization, and the only person who could, the only thing that could break it up is the EU itself, and I don't think it would be in their interest to do so. It would really fragment the market badly.
There's someone in the middle there, I think, was next, actually. There are many, many people queuing up to ask, so we have to sort of go in a certain sequence, I think.
All this makes universities, in terms of the delivery of intellectual content, sound very 18th and, or even earlier,
very
18th century. What do you think we ought to be doing
Let me tell you, first of all, why I don't think that's true. I mean, the intellectual model of the university truly is 19th century in the departmental sense, but going back, it's medieval in its origins. I think if you look at any vital business sector, it has, in terms of innovation, strong links to the university community. Certainly in California, that's the case. If you took Berkeley and Stanford out of the valley in the Bay Area, there would be no software hardware business. I mean, those two universities practically gave rise to to Silicon Valley. And there's a very strong link between USC and UCLA in the entertainment business, as well as other universities like NYU and New York. I think the opportunities, not only for LSE, but other schools that are focused on media, as what I really said earlier, is going to be the key driver of the 21st century, they're vast. Because just in this brief talk, I've talked about 10 different businesses that you can wind up in. I'll give you another example. I would argue that Nike, yeah, is a media company. I would argue that Calvin Klein and Ralph Lauren and Giorgio Armani are media companies. I would argue that General Motors and Rover and Ferrari.
Tottenham Hotspur.
Okay, and sports and Tony's soccer team. They're all media companies for a couple of reasons. Again, I go back to McLuhan. You know, his theory or justification of media is that it's an extension of the self. Fashion, extension of the skin, media company. Automotive, extension of the feet, media company. What was the other one I used? Computer business, extension of the central nervous system, media company. And by the time you add on the tens of billions of dollars spent marketing these products, by definition, they merge into media. So I think, you know, what I would be thinking about in terms of creating or carving out opportunities for yourself is look at some end of the various businesses and say, where do you fit in terms of your own intellectual interests? What part of the market engages you? You know, research, operations, programming, creative, marketing, distribution. I think there'll be hundreds of thousands of new jobs replacing all the people who've been laid off in the financial sectors.
Many years ago as a student here, I studied something which I was told was called the economics of education and human capital, which I later discovered is now called intellectual property, and in fact that's how I now make a living, I'm glad to say. So I want to thank LSE for that. You actually mentioned at the beginning talent as essentially one of the three elements. I think you talked about the creativity, you talked about distribution, and then tools. And I think you said that talent is generally regarded as being independent of the media companies, in that individual talent is discrete and so on and so forth. I'm particularly interested in the fact that 30, 40, 50, I suppose, years ago, I think United Artists was founded on the basis that individual talents came together in a sort of cooperative.
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, United Artists, at the time it was formed, was a counterintuitive business,
yeah,
because it was also an extremely low overhead business. It didn't have all the trappings of studio infrastructure and economics. And, of course, they had a very successful run, but they finally ran out of gas. And then it was taken over by Transamerica, and then it crashed and burned, and now it is an irrelevancy.
Right.
Except it's now part of MGM, but it doesn't have the level of production robustness or market clout that it had perhaps 20 years ago. But I think the point is that talent within the studio structure was formally aligned because it was operating under the contract system. Talent now is pretty much free market, freelance. You go from studio to studio.
But in one form of talent, if I can just ask you this, and that's in music, composers of music, how do they protect their performing rights in particular, which, as you know, essentially are generated after the event,
yeah,
in this new world of not only internet distribution and performance, but also, of course, in the world of e-commerce,
well,
in
there,
the 55 there billion
will, there will have to be software generated that deals with the protection of ownership and the prevention of theft. But what's also true about the music business is that as the composer or songwriter, the bulk of the money you make may not be from the mechanical sales of the recordings directly, the CDs or the cassettes. They'll come from the residual rights generated through performance licenses or synchronization rights when it appears on other forms. So the publishing rights in music, you know, are as valuable as the recording rights of the band.
Thank you.
Someone else at the top there. Just shout, we can hear, I think.
Your speech is focused on America and Europe. But do you think media companies in the developed world can also create some value in the developing world in countries like China, Mexico, Brazil? And if the answer is yes, do you have a strategy for that? Thank you.
Well, I think the Western media companies, as I said earlier, you know, are subject to the fallacy of the West. And they're going to have to begin to develop specific marketing and distribution strategies in China, in India, in Southeast Asia. And you're seeing companies doing that. The problem is it's not that simple in China in terms of getting licenses to do business, although it appears as though Mr. Murdoch is going to be able to get Star finally in that footprint. You know, it's a giant market, highly entrepreneurial market. I think the Western companies have not only the desire to do it, I think they have an obligation to do it. And one of the things that I've observed over the world, not over the last several years, and I've, you know, I've traveled probably in 65 countries, is there seem to be three dominant trends. You know, when I talked about the holy trinity of information, news, and information, and communication, what we're seeing in the developing economies is, one, globalization of exports, democratization, which frees up the ability to get your products placed without fear of censorship or restriction or political reprisals. And third, electrification. The first thing that happens when a dam is built in India and electricity comes into a village is someone's buying a TV and a VCR at the same time they're buying a toaster oven. So I think this becomes unavoidable just at a primary cultural level. And I think the smart companies are going to place very heavy bets in the next century on those emerging markets.
I'm interested in the political implications of what you've been saying. Given that the imploding and the collapse of Eastern European governments was not engineered by the CIA, but was ably assisted, I think, by the superiority of Western media, are we not faced with these new developments with a 1984 scenario, not ruled by Big Brother, but Big Brothers who are the media moguls?
I think that's a good question. I think one of the problems of this digital world we enter in is that if you've been following the Microsoft antitrust case in America, one of the key pieces of evidence that the government is relying on is email. And email lives forever. It cannot be erased. It's in cyberspace. So when you press delete, not really. And I think the problem that comes out of that is one of developing discrete systems of communication and privacy versus public access. But I think these media companies have tremendous influence politically as well as economically. I remember I was in Europe in 1967 when the Israeli war was going on, and there was a CBS truck that drove through the Gaza Strip, and people surrendered to the news truck because it had that big eye, the CBS eye, and they didn't know what it was other than it was something that violated their sense of Islamic decorum, and they laid down their guns and surrendered to a news truck. The second part of that is just look at the influence CNN had in Baghdad, you know, where Saddam's advisors were watching television to find out what was going on in their own war. So the power of news organizations is formidable. And, you know, I also believe, you know, you've got some extremely valuable news franchises in the UK. I mean, if BBC actually gets down to globally marketing world service, it's a killer. I mean, that should be competing day and date with CNN as well as Reuters.
Should we take someone back? Do you want to take the microphone? Because people upstairs can hear you then.
Today, broadcast by the British television, is absolutely appalling, considering the amount of titillation and the manipulation of the camera on the audience. It's awful. Recently, 6 weeks ago, I made a trip to San Francisco and watched a two-hour documentary by the PBS, Public Broadcasting Service. There was not one single special effects in that 2 hours. It was completely unbiased and straightforward documentary about Lloyd Wright, the architect, showing his architecture as it was, not with the glittery and glitzy lights and special bazaars and so on and so forth. That's my opinion.
Sorry. Okay. I live in Los Angeles, so I'm not an expert on BBC documentary, but I guess you're right.
In the middle here.
Hi. Earlier in your lecture, in your discussion, you mentioned companies such as Time Warner and Seagram's and how those companies have delved into other technology, other industries, the technology industry. How has a company like Bertelsmann been able to maintain its dominant position in the media communication industry without going into the cable business or what have you? Or perhaps I'm speaking in ignorance, but...
Well, Bertelsmann is a unique case in point. It's a European media structure with significant holdings in publishing and in music and in television in Europe. Because of its foreign ownership, it cannot own a network or a cable property in the United States. So it's not going to be able to be in those businesses unless they find a way to backdoor that transaction or unless the Federal Communications Commission changes its laws. But they do have significant online interests that they're building, and they have a new chairman who named Thomas Middelhoff, who is very committed to growth in the online market, and I think they've got a very good operating strategy. They're also, I think, a key partner in America Online, yeah? Think so.
Put someone next to the auburn haired lady over there.
Interested in your use of rent and obviously media as a commodification. David Bowie recently transformed himself into a bond and sold very well on Wall Street. Are we going to see talent, which you talk a lot about, turned into a commodity and turned into something which is ultimately yielding a rent? Right. So are we going to see this with all sorts of media talent?
Well, this gentleman is referring to something fondly called Bowie bonds on Wall Street. David Bowie decided to monetize the value of his recording royalties and discount it forward, take the cash, and then pay it back over time out of receipts as it comes through, while paying a strip coupon. I don't see artists generally doing that. I think in the situation of Mr. Bowie, he probably needed some cash. It was fully secured by the record company, but it's not a free lunch. And artists like getting money, but they don't like paying it back. So I think that was an interesting financial instrument that was created, but and there have been a couple of others who have gone along that area in the recorded music area, but I don't think in film and television you're going to see that as a product. But the heart of your question, which I think is correct, is talent as commodity has the ability to generate, you know, in economic terms, an exchange mechanism. It can create an auction model which can be traded, and that's unusual.
Hi. Just following on that Bowie thing, I think it's interesting that he has set up BowieNet as well, so he's got his own ISP. Maybe that's what he needed the cash for. But I had two things I wanted to ask. The first was, you were talking about globalization and democratization with Star TV. Didn't they drop BBC coverage? And, you know, now they're able to get a foothold in China. So I don't know how democratic that is. And the other thing is, with the creation of value, it's quite interesting if you look at the field of IT. Linux, the most successful operating system, is all based on free source code, and the same goes for Netscape. As technology is so integral to the growth of media, do you think there are lessons to be learned from that kind of community development?
I think software is likely to be given away as a means of driving new services, and the Netscape example is a good case in point, but there is certain proprietary software which also will command a very high economic value, especially in the area of enterprise resource planning. Companies like Oracle, SAP, Bonn, PeopleSoft develop very discrete modular software for businesses where you both run the front end and the back end, and the licensing prices for those software packages, I think, will remain at a very high premium. But other kinds of software that might help you, that might enable you to get video or music off the internet itself, I think is going to become a commodity function because it'll lead you to someplace else that will generate another form of value.
I'm afraid I think this has to be the last question. There's someone at the back there. I apologize to other people who were lined up to ask questions.
You mentioned you felt lucky that you didn't have to take bets on technology, but as talent becomes more virtual and you see reincarnations of people who are dead appear in movies, how do you deal with the complexities of dealing with virtual characters?
First of all, have you been talking to our client, Shirley MacLaine? There's something called digital mapping, which allows programmers and software engineers to capture data points of characters and recreate them in a digital format. Under the rights and permissions theory, heirs have rights to the deceased, and a lot of heirs are licensing those rights for new utilizations. You've seen it in advertisements involving John Wayne, Marilyn Monroe, Humphrey Bogart. Voice as well as image, where they'll extrapolate a character in an old movie, isolate it, and reformat it. So these things are forever. And the minute they're in a digital environment, they're really forever. I don't know. Mrs. Barney.
As they say, I'm afraid we have to draw to a close, but this is the last public lecture of this calendar year, and I hope everyone will agree that it was one of the very best. And if running a media company makes you that good a lecturer, I should send some of the LSE lecturers off to learn their trade. I thought it was exceptionally fluid and compelling performance, and I'd like to thank Jeff Berg very, very much for producing such obviously stimulating debate for the audience.
Thank you for having us.